Beautiful April 16th, 2020. My name is Louise Devery Bjorkman. I am joined on the panel today by Judge Peter Reyes and by Judge Susan Siegel. The next matter on our case for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Matthew Kajava. I would note for the record that the State of Minnesota is listed as a respondent but is not participating in this appeal. We will nonetheless, as per our rules, consider the case on its merits. You will have appellant's lawyer 15 minutes to present your argument. Please begin by stating your name and identifying the party you represent. And I'm going to ask you a preliminary question. Can you see the cell phone on which the timing is going to be displayed?
I can, Your Honor.
Great. We had an issue with that earlier today in a prior argument. So anyway, with that, you may proceed.
All right. Well, thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Grant Gibo. I am an attorney appearing today on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Matthew Kajava. I'm a special assistant state public defender through the State Public Defender's Pro Bono Appellate Program. The main issue today and the reason that we're here is that the trial court below in Mr. Kajava's case committed clear legal error by incorrectly holding that an individual's status as a probationer is in and of itself sufficient to justify a seizure and subsequent search of their person. It's a very narrow legal issue that's before us today. Below, both the state and appellate both agreed that this issue is dispositive to the case, and the case was submitted on this narrow issue itself.
But counsel, would you agree that even if the district court erred by saying simply having a search condition of your probation permits the search under the Fourth Amendment, if that's wrong, can't we nonetheless review the record to see if in fact the seizure and search was valid under the Fourth Amendment?
Yep, and that's correct, Your Honor. There's two real standards of review at issue in this case. The first is going to be the clearly erroneous standard with the court's below's legal conclusion regarding the facts of the matter. And then this court does have de novo review in order to look into both the constitutional issue, because we're raising a constitutional challenge under both the Minnesota and the federal constitutions. Regarding the actual search and seizure itself, we don't even need to get to that question because of the court's incorrect circular logic below. And if you look at the record at the trial court's decision, I have it attached as a page 2 to our addendum. The trial court says that a valid basis for the search exists because the defendant is a probationer subject to random searches and seizures as set forth in his probation conditions. And as an initial matter, that's just incorrect and circular, because you know, the fact that he is on probation essentially takes the search standard from probable cause down to reasonable suspicion, but it doesn't supply reasonable suspicion to search on its own. If that was the case, there would really be no reasonable search standard. And, you know, doubling down on...
Gibo, can I stop you there? Would you agree that the proper standard is reasonable articulable suspicion?
Oh, correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And the trial court correctly notes that, but the trial court's error in this case is that it's saying that, you know, because he's a probationer, he's subject to a reasonable suspicion standard. Because he's a probationer, reasonable suspicion was met. That essentially eliminates the reasonable suspicion requirement, and that's against both this court and then the United States Supreme Court's holding regarding the search of probationers like the appellant.
Well, I agree with you in the sense that United States versus Knights suggests that reasonable suspicion is probably what's required, although the holding in that case says no more than reasonable suspicion is required to search a probationer. Do we need to decide that if, as you have, I think, already agreed, we can look to the underlying record and decide whether there was reasonable suspicion to seize and search your client?
Yes, Your Honor. So the court, as I stated, does have de novo review regarding this. But, you know, the first question is whether or not the trial court below committed a clearly erroneous finding. And that's under the state Supreme Court's holding in Milton. And here, the trial court made a clearly erroneous finding because they applied this wrong circular standard. And to that effect, you know, not only does the trial court say that reasonable suspicion existed because appellant was a probationer, the trial court doubles down on that in the exact same paragraph, saying that, you know, even if the deputy in this case couldn't establish a reasonable basis for his search, that doesn't matter because he's a probationer. So essentially, the trial court took the standard, threw it out the window, and said, hey, he's subject to random searches. We don't even need to meet the reasonable suspicion standard.
Right. And let's assume for the sake of the remaining argument that we agree with you. The district court erred as a matter of law. Why doesn't the record, notwithstanding what the district court found, why doesn't the record establish reasonable suspicion for this sheriff's deputy to seize and search your client?
Sure, Your Honor. So if I may just briefly highlight the facts that lead to the actual seizure, because the relevant snapshot that the court should be looking at for this is going to be at the time that appellant was seized by the officer in this case. It's sort of a weird set of facts. My client was fishing in the city of Baudette, Minnesota, which is up near Lake of the Woods. It's a fishing community that's pretty clearly admitted in the record. Essentially,
he's the walleye capital of the world. I'm not sure. I've driven through. I think there's a big fish on one of the street corners.
You know, it certainly wouldn't surprise me. When you go up north, there's, you know, Walker has the giant muskie. I'm sure that there's many, many giant fish up north. But he's in a fishing community. It's August 20th. He has a fishing license. He's fishing at sunset. He gets approached by a conservation officer. The conservation officer speaks with him and his travel companion for 45 minutes. So it's a 45-minute conversation with a conservation officer. That officer finds that there's nothing, you know, suspicious going on. There's no reason to justify a search.
Doesn't he though find that both your client and his companion were acting unreasonably nervous, responding a little bit differently than he would expect them to under the circumstances?
So, Your Honor, that is going to be Officer Platts, who is the second officer who approaches my client and his travel companion.
The deputy, as opposed to the conservationer. Okay.
Yep. So this nervousness occurred, after a 45-minute conversation between my client and then another uniformed officer. So to get to your question, whether or not there is sufficient nervousness to justify a search, in order for nervousness to constitute a factor for, you know, a search, the officer has to point to specific facts that show that nervousness ties to a suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. Now here, candidly, Your Honor, if I was spoken to by a police officer for 45 minutes, it's very likely that I would be acting nervous as well, because that's a very long interaction with officers for any citizen, let alone someone with a probation search condition to interact with them. So
Right. But counsel, I mean, we defer to an officer's ability to see things and note things that would escape somebody who's not a trained police officer. And it seems to me that police officers they're dealing with the public all the time. So they see people who are nervous just because they're having to deal with a police officer versus somebody who is acting a little suspicious or unorthodox or nervous in a way that is not the typical nervousness that maybe you or I would have if we were approached or pulled over by an officer. And that seems to be what occurred here, is the deputy noted unusual nervousness by appellant.
So Your Honor, I would agree with you on that, with the caveat that officers still need to point to something that ties that nervousness to a suspicion of criminal activity that's afoot. And second, you know, the second officer, so Officer Platts, his determination that appellant was acting nervously occurred after the seizure had occurred. So there's a preliminary question of whether or not appellant would have been seized for a investigatory search before the nervousness factors came into play. So the timing of this matters.
Can I interrupt just for a minute here? It's also in the record that neither of them had a license for the right kind of license for the truck that they were driving. So wouldn't that give a reasonable basis for Officer Platts to have approached them and asked further questions and asked for identification again? Because the first was a conservation officer, so his role kind of begins and ends with, do they have fishing licenses? Right. And so then he talked to the, you know, local law enforcement And that seems to be kind of a basis, unless I'm misremembering the record, which is possible, but I think it is in the record here.
So, Your Honor, if and again, I hope that I'm accurately stating the record as well, but my understanding is when the conservation officer approached the party, he checked for fishing licenses, and my client had a fishing license. He was fishing at a public pier in, a city with a lake. As far as the question about a valid license, I do not recall it being. They had, an incorrect class of license for the vehicle that they were driving. My understanding is that his travel partner did not have a valid driver's license, or maybe his driver's license was expired. But that shouldn't go to the reasonable suspicion for the search, or excuse me, for the seizure of appellant, because all of this occurred after the first conservation officer left. Spoke with the deputy who then came back, seized the appellant, and then different events happened that led to the search. But when what our contention is that that actual seizure was not justified by a reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot, because at this point, all the officers knew was that there was an individual who was fishing with a fishing license at a fishing pier at sunset in Baudette.
Well, but the universe of information I think available to the sheriff's deputy went beyond that. I mean, if I recall correctly, you have the conservation officer not only observing some nervous behavior, which I acknowledge in and of itself, it would not probably rise to the standard of reasonable suspicion, but he also observed that your client and his companion were giving inconsistent stories about what they've been doing and what was going on. He learned that your client had criminal history, including multiple recent convictions for felony controlled substance crimes. And the deputy also understood, I think, from talking to the conservation officer, that your client had been at the home of a known drug user in the time before he went fishing. And was, of course, on probation. Why isn't that universe of information that the deputy had before he started even talking to your client? Why isn't that enough to justify the seizure?
Well, as one correction, Your Honor, the individual who the officer identified my client was at the home of, it's a little unclear what her role is in all of this. It's not that she's a known drug user, it's that she's someone who had been identified in conjunction with a drug warrant in the past. It's not that she was the subject of the warrant, that's not what the record says. It's not that she was like a known user.
But the
Nevertheless,
fact that, but the fact that your client had a criminal history of substance control, controlled substance violations, and that, and the nervous behavior, and the inconsistent statements, and I think the deputy also said he thought it was unusually late that they were out fishing. Why wasn't that enough to constitute reasonable suspicion to justify the question, at least, what are your probation terms?
So none of those factors standing alone, and I'll get to the totality analysis as well, Your Honor, but none of those factors standing alone, it's clear in the case law, constitutes reasonable suspicion to infringe upon someone's right against search and seizure. So having an account or having some sort of known contact with a quote unquote known drug user is not in and of itself sufficient. We briefed that. I unfortunately don't remember the case off the top of my head. I agree with Judge Ray's point earlier that an officer is able to articulate things that an average person doesn't. That a layperson isn't going to be able to identify as potentially indicative of criminal behavior. But to your point, the fact that the officer thought it was unusual that he was fishing at a fishing pier at sunset in Baudette, there still has to be some step in order to justify this infringement that the officer is going to have to tie. I thought it was unusual that he was fishing at the pier. Because of that, I suspected he was involved with some sort of criminal activity. That step, that little piece, is what's missing from this case. You don't need to have reasonable suspicion that someone is acting unusually. You have to have reasonable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. So that's the difference. So when you look at each individual factor, none of those alone support it. And even when you look at them in the totality, When you put them all together, it doesn't add up to the fact that criminal activity is afoot. You have an individual who is fishing with a fishing license, and you know, in Baudette, that in and of itself is not sufficient to justify the seizure and then the subsequent search. So, Your Honors,
why is that not enough? I mean, it's each of those individually. I agree with you that individually, each one of those alone is not enough to meet the reasonable articulable standard, but each one case law does make clear that those individually, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, can lead to a reasonable articulable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot. And I think one of the key aspects of the facts here are the fact that appellant acknowledged that he had been at the home of a person who the police knew to be regularly involved in drug activity. And that is something that seems to tie all of the activities to point to, well, maybe there is actually some activity afoot, and we've got the reasonable articulable standard here, not the probable cause. So as long as there's some articulation of it, which ties together all of these individual things, why isn't that enough to meet that standard, which is really not that high?
And Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I address your question?
You may answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the facts of this case, so the other factors that the officer points to in order to argue that there was you know, some factors that justified the stop. To give you, a different hypothetical, it would be a different story if, you know, appellant was in this park, this fishing park at, I don't know, 3 in the morning, as opposed to at sunset fishing, because then the other innocent factors, which the officer is supposedly using to tie the association with the known user, would lead to the logical conclusion that there was criminal activity afoot. But here, even when you put all of the pieces together, they still don't support, you know, a determination that there was criminal activity happening. So, you know, we can see that you can use multiple factors in the totality of the circumstances, but all of those pieces still need to add up to some sort of showing that criminal activity was afoot. And here, because those innocent factors aren't related to the interaction that the appellant had with a known, you know, a known person to the police, they're so far attenuated and unrelated to one another that they shouldn't be able to bolster an otherwise impermissible factor. So because that alone is insufficient, these other innocent factors don't help to turn that alone insufficient factor into a sufficient factor.
Great. Thank you, counsel. Judge Reyes, Judge Siegel, any additional questions?
Nope.
All right. Thank you then, Mr. Gipo, for your argument today, and for I think the technology worked in this argument, so I'm hopeful that can continue to be effective as the Court of Appeals in hearing our cases. We will take the matter under advisement, issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank
I appreciate
very much.
The time.
Thank you,
Mr. Chiwa.